you know, as I got further and further down that road after well over a decade of pushing the sport forward and being at the top and being on that flywheel of trying to keep it going, things just started to crumble. My marriage started to crumble. My body started to crumble. I started to try and take a bit more of a bird's eye view of what I wanted in life, what actually brought me joy, what actually brought me connection, what actually I felt good after a day of doing. And I just started to realize that life is just full of nuance, and to really try and appreciate that and learn from that and let that soak in, as maddening and frustrating as that is sometimes. You know, sometimes it's just so easy to look at things as black and white or right or wrong or something like that. But, you know, really letting that nuance in is something that still teaches me lessons today.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Travis Macy coming in from 7,000 feet in beautiful, sunny Salida, Colorado. It is almost May, folks, and that means official summertime. Woohoo! Running, biking, exploring. Heck, maybe you're even going to go rock climbing. That's one of the things we'll talk about today. I am very excited to bring you an interview with Beth Rodden. She's a climbing legend, and we're talking about her new book, A Light Through the Cracks. Beth is one of the best female rock climbers of all time and a globally recognized ambassador for the outdoor community. She's achieved a number of notable free climbs on El Capitan, the 3,000-foot monolith in Yosemite National Park, and has also established the hardest first ascent of a crack climb ever done by a woman. She's been climbing for 30 years, and she hopes to be climbing for 30 more. She lives with her family in California. Beth's new book, again, it's called A Light Through the Cracks, A Climber's Story. Hit shelves this week, folks, May 1st. Print, ebook, audiobook. I was lucky enough to get an early copy, and it is awesome. Highly recommended. Really enjoyed talking with Beth about the book. And I tell you what, you know, in addition to all that that bio stuff, Beth just strikes me as a good person. She's approachable. She's humble. She's down to earth. She's vulnerable. A lot of that comes across in her writing, and I think came out in our conversation as well. Thanks to our presenting sponsor, Rourke. Rourke invites you to run amok. One of my favorite items in the Rourke clothing line is called the Bless Up Trail Shirt. This is a high-performance button-up. It's micro-perforated, ultra-light, and quick-dry. It adds a touch of style to your everyday kit. Whether you are running, hiking, climbing, or riding, this shirt will do more than just keep up. Seriously, it's awesome. It feels good, protects you from the sun while also being super breathable. And one little secret, one thing I like to do with this Bless Up shirt when I'm out there mountain biking, I'll actually unbutton all the buttons except for maybe the top button or the top two buttons. And that allows just a lot of cool airflow while still providing that sun protection on the back. So check it out, the Bless Up Trail Shirt. You can find that at Rourke.com, where you can use the code MACY15, all caps, to get yourself 15% off. Again, Rourke.com. All right, folks, thanks as always for listening. And here we are, me and Beth Rodden, chatting about her new book and more. Beth, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming and just excited to talk with you about your new book, A Light Through the Cracks. It's on shelves May 1st, and it's awesome. It's just, you know, it's a great narrative. I think at the outset, you know, we get a play-by-play of just, you know, some stories of the lore of the climbing world. But even more so, to me, it shows this process of growth, you know, basically a young person becoming an adult and becoming a nuanced and mature person. And I so much enjoyed reading it. I enjoyed your reflection on it. I wrote down a few descriptors for this book, Beth, if I can share them. I found it to be exciting, honest, wise, nuanced, reflective, vulnerable, instructive, inspiring, and also at many times funny, which I really enjoyed. So anyway, congrats on the book. And maybe my first question, Beth, is you say at the outset that a book is a snapshot in time written by an author at a point in time. And that really resonated with me as I think back on the books I've written. You know, if I wrote them now, like the things would be different. Not that I regret anything I wrote, but it's that snapshot. So tell us why this book, why now, and kind of what is your point in time right now?
Yeah. I mean, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. But gosh, I feel like why now, why this book? I've been working on a book for nearly a decade now at various, you know, varying degrees of intensity. But I feel like I always gain the most and the most connection between people with hearing their stories and sharing stories. And so I feel like sharing your human stories and your whole self really makes those human connections. And I mean, I feel like that's one of the greatest things.
Yeah. Excellent. I'm glad that you wrote it now, because I think, you know, even looking back on events, you know, from your early 20s, I think the perspective now is just so much more powerful, you know, maybe than it would have been, you know, 10 years ago. Or I think now you're in your mid 40s, like, you know, we grow, we change. Hopefully we become wise.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure if I wrote this book in my 20s or 30s, it would have been vastly different. And I'm sure when I'm, you know, if I'm lucky enough to make it to 50, 60, 70, 80, then I would look back and think, oh, I think about things totally differently then compared to now. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing, you know, having different perspectives at different times.
Yeah. Well, we can get into maybe some key points in the book, whether it's the narrative of Kyrgyzstan and some of your, you know, kind of key climbs that you give us this great play by play that's like super fun to read through. But what I want to start with is this kind of you know, sort of nuanced maturation process of what I think of as the athlete mindset. And a lot of what I read, Beth, it just resonated so much with me personally. You know, I don't have much experience climbing, but in the endurance sports that I've done, adventure racing and other things, like, you know, there's some similar kind of stuff. And early on in the book, I think what I'd like to do here, I want to share, you know, some of these themes early on that come up. And then let's contrast that a bit with later in the book as you're reflecting back, you know, maybe a greater purpose or just a different view. So throughout the book, again, especially talking about, you know, in your 20s, you were climbing hard, you were, you know, at the very top. It was magazine covers, it was sponsorships, you know, all these things, a lot of achievement and definitely an achievement orientation. You also talk about this idea of sort of the importance of being a good girl, like saying yes, especially to sponsors, photo shoots, the next big send. That was kind of part of your story or your mindset. You talk a lot about contingent self-worth. You discuss other climbers and especially other women are competitors and definitely not friends, you know, kind of a battle for the small pieces of the pie that exist. You had a sense of that you must send to keep the sponsors. There was at times intense criticism of your own body and some, you know, potentially unhealthy eating patterns. You were dismissive at times of your own accomplishments. I think maybe you refer to sort of some perfectionism at times in climbing in other areas. There was a lot of comparison, you know, to yourself, to other female athletes, even to Tommy, you know, who is your boyfriend and then husband and also climbing partner. There was kind of a sense at times of like, oh, if there's a problem, let's just exercise into oblivion, you know, and it'll kind of go away. And again, all these things, Beth, like they resonate very much, like, you know, sort of been there, I guess. I haven't been a female athlete, but I, you know, I know that sense. I know that maybe some of those challenges, maybe an all or nothing sort of mindset. And at times even this sense again, which I've experienced, whether subconsciously or even more so, that sort of like athletes are better. Like it's us, you know, we're not normal people. We're not, you know, like the hell with normal life, like, you know, a higher calling, right? So anyway, I don't know, any, you can reflect on that stuff if you want, or if you want, you can skip to kind of this, you know, looking back or sort of this newer version of yourself.
No, I mean, that was all, I think that was such a huge foundation of, you know, my early adulthood was all those kind of dialogues and things that as a climber, I subscribed to and I truly believed in and I was on board with, you know, that somehow I was better than normal people, that I was winning because I wasn't in this a cubicle with fluorescent, you know, lights overhead. And that, you know, just constantly pursuing and chasing achievement and perfection in that achievement would bring happiness or content or whatever you want to label it as. But, you know, as I got further and further down that road after, you know, well over a decade of pushing the sport forward and being at the top and kind of being on that flywheel of trying to keep it going, you know, things just started to crumble. My marriage started to crumble. My body started to crumble. And it was kind of in that, you know, cascade downwards, some might call it, that I was started to kind of try and take a bit more of a bird's eye view of, you know, what I wanted in life, what actually brought me joy, what actually brought me connection, what actually, you know, I felt good after a day of doing. And it wasn't like all or nothing, right? It wasn't like, well, definitely no climbing and no goals and nothing like that, only this other thing. But, you know, I just started to realize that life is just full of nuance, you know, and to really try and appreciate that and learn from that and let that soak in, as maddening and frustrating as that is sometimes, you know, sometimes it's just so easy to look at things as black and white or right or wrong or something like that. But, you know, really letting that nuance in is something that still teaches me lessons today. So.
Yeah. I like what you share about kind of the adversity and the challenge. Often it creates this reckoning where, you know, where we have to reassess, and maybe we go back to how things were, maybe we change. You know, sometimes I wonder, is it possible to have the growth without the adversity, you know, whether it's the diagnosis, the injury, the relationship. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, maybe that's impossible to answer. I know for me that like it has been the challenge, the forced challenges, you know, that have forced change, which as it usually turns out to be, you know, positive, but,
yeah, I mean, I think every situation, every lesson you learn is probably so wildly unique to each person. So, yeah, have I learned a lot from like the adversity and those kind of like big challenges? Definitely. Have I also learned a lot from moments of joy and, you know, happiness and maybe slowness? For sure. And so I feel like for me, maybe to label one higher than the other is a bit hard, just because kind of categorizing things I feel like is always a little bit hard, like which one's more important or which one's not. But I think I've learned lessons from both, and yeah.
Nice. You say towards the end, there's a line like, you know, maybe it's possible to have fun and climb hard. And you just said like, oh, it wasn't all or nothing as far as climbing versus normal life or whatever. Was there ever any points where there was an inclination like, oh, if I'm not climbing, you know, whatever, the magazine cover, the send, the, you know, pushing the sport forward, if I'm not doing that, then screw it. Like, why climb at all? Did you ever have moments or periods like that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I feel like in the handful of years after my divorce, I kind of just like cascaded down from this really elite top level climber to this elementary climber. You know, I couldn't climb things that I'm sure beginners could without some part of my body popping or snapping or whatnot. And, you know, I distinctly remember having these moments and just being like, is all this anguish actually worth it? Like, why am I doing this? You know, like clearly there's other ways to lead life. Like, why am I in this community? Why am I in this realm of climbing that right now is giving me, you know, so many troubles and I feel like is taking away more than it's giving to me. So I definitely had like a pretty long stretch, I'd say a year or two of that, of kind of vacillating back and forth. But, you know, during that time, I just really tried to take a step back from how I did pursue climbing for so long. And I tried to, you know, just give myself the, you know, grace and space to discover and see if I wanted to keep, you know, climbing and in my life. And if so, how I wanted to keep it in my life. Like, did I need to keep it at this one, like the super fast paced, you know, go, 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 only climbing hard level? Or could it have a kind of like different role in my life? Or was it a little bit of both or whatnot? So,
yeah. Excellent. Well, let's go to a passage from the book. I'd love to hear it in your own words. You know, there's so many things I marked in this book that just stood out to me. I think people are going to enjoy reading it. And to set the scene, you know, here you are. This is sometime fairly recent. You're in your 40s. You've become a mom. You're, you know, toying with this line of like we said, climb hard and have fun. And you know, it's often bouldering and families together. The kids are running around. They're fighting with sticks. They've got a base, you know, up on top of some rock that you say a lot of people would think is dangerous, but that's just kind of, you know, what you and your friends and the kids do. So it's a much different scene, but you're also, you're finding ways to push yourself and also to be maybe for the first time in decades, what I love seeing, being comfortable in your own body and, you know, climbing with a sports bra on and sharing what that means to, you know, to have a body that looks different than it did in the past, but is also like has strength and power. So anyway, that's kind of where we're at. Well, go ahead. I'll let you read from there.
Okay. If someone had told me in my 20s that I would feel more alive being a mom or being in love or having a day out with my girlfriends than I did while I was freeing a route on El Cap, I would have nodded and smiled and walked away thinking they had no idea what they were talking about. Why would I pursue some normal, boring, run-of-the-mill life when I was seeking and achieving excellence? Did they know what it was like to hang off of a cliff 3,000 feet up in the air? Did they know what it was like to travel to far corners of the earth and climb a mountain, to have companies pay them to do what they loved to do most? Did they know how to suffer to become extraordinary? But I had surprised myself so much in the past decade. I was learning that life wasn't an equation to be solved, that it wasn't a matter of controlling all the pieces, my body, my eating, my training, my social circle, my marriage, and putting them in the correct places to achieve the desired result. I had treated myself like a robot for so long, thinking my discipline made me better than regular people. I finally understood that pursuing greatness didn't fill me the way a normal life did. If I wanted to have a big life, I needed to live a smaller one.
Thanks for sharing that, Beth. Anything there stand out to you? Looking back, you know, who knows, you probably wrote this a while ago. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, even now it's like, it's a nice reminder to myself because, you know, it's easy to fall back into things. But yeah, it's I think that's the big contrast for me is, you know, remembering the life before and then trying to look at a slower pace of life, a slower life in general. And it's not better or worse, you know, it's just like, it can be equally as rewarding.
Yeah. Let me, if I can, I want to read one short paragraph on the next page. Cause it really stands out to me. You know, you're continuing with this climb, you're with Randy, your husband, and you're pushing hard, you fall off. And then you say, I laughed. I had forgotten how good it felt to dwell on a physical challenge, the quickness of breath, the burning in my forearms, the racing heart, how addicting it was. My dozen years with Randy and all the therapy I'd gone through had showed me other paths to being human, to being happy, to being okay. But in that moment, I realized maybe this path was valid too. Man, I love that. What I like about it, Beth, or why it speaks to me personally, is that the joy and the intensity and the scratching that itch of pushing hard, you know, whatever that means, whether we climb as hard or go as fast or whatever as we used to, like, it's still there and it's also valid. And I appreciate that you say that. And I appreciate, what I'm seeing is you've learned maybe to, I don't know, to scratch that itch or to, you know, express yourself in this important way. But it doesn't have to be the total extreme. It doesn't have to be, you know, again, the whatever, the nose or meltdown, you know, these epic things you've done. Like, for me, it was like big race every month, year round, like, boom, that is what I do. That's who I am. And that was kind of the only thing I knew. And I've learned, like, okay, well, maybe I do a thing here or there and I still scratch that itch, or maybe I scratch it out riding by myself or with my buddies or with my kids. It's the same feeling, different way, but it's also just as good and it's valid.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I feel like that's that whole nuance thing, right? I feel like, at least as a climber, how I always approach things was like, it was either on or off, right? There was like no in between. And so it's like black or white or whatnot. And you know, it doesn't have to be that way. And I don't even think it has to be that way to be pretty darn good at what you do, you know? That's how I pursued it for so long, but I don't think that's the only way.
Yeah. I mean, you talk, there's great stories from the training that you and Tommy did. You know, again, I guess probably in your 20s, you know, you guys are in Boulder and Estes Park, and it's like, you know, like you run in the morning, you climb all day, and then you like go to the gym, you know, either in Boulder or like the homemade gym, you know, with these torture devices and stuff, and just kill yourselves until like you can't move anything, and then, you know, fall asleep on the pad and wake up the next day. But yeah, it's like, it's 300%, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, it's all or nothing. It's like in or out.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. Shifting focus a little bit, friendships. You talk about adult friendships here, and especially at the end of the book, well, you talk about various phases. You talk about, like we said, you know, periods of, especially between yourself and maybe a handful of other elite female climbers, like you weren't friends, you were competitors, and you're not sharing beta on climbs, I would imagine, or let's say connections to potential sponsors, that kind of stuff. Like, all of that, it's held tight at the chest, and I mean, I can see why, like, limited resources. And then you move on to like a current friendship. You found a great friend in an ironic place. It's Becca Caldwell, Tommy's wife. Like, tell us about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was younger, I never had that many girlfriends even before climbing. And then in climbing, there were just so few of us that even if we might be friendly, I can't speak for anybody else, but you know, I always had this like little bit of a thing in the back of my head being like, oh wait, but you know, we're also vying for like the same thing, you know, we're also vying for that same spot. And so maybe don't get too close. And so it was always had kind of this asterisk with it or whatnot. But fast forward into, you know, going through divorce, becoming a mom. And I feel like those are two of the most vulnerable times people can have in their lives, and kind of all these guardrails that are up or just down, and you know, you're just looking for connection and that type of thing. And especially in motherhood, it's such a new thing for everybody, right? It's like, and it's such this, it can be a massive transformation. And so, Becca's oldest is a little bit, about a year older than our kiddo. And it was just this time where we were in the same places, you know, and not that many young kids around. And, you know, she's an amazing person and it's, you know, hard not to want to invite that into your life and have that connection and have that support. And, yeah, it's an amazing thing, friendship, when you let it be all that it can be. And it's been a pleasant surprise for me in the past decade or so when I didn't have it for so long, when I didn't value it for so long in my life.
Yeah. Good for you. Good for both of you. And, yeah. And I mean, good for parenthood. Isn't it neat how, you know, having kids and kids doing kid things, whether that's playing the park, school, sports teams, whatever, for many parents, it's a great way for parents to make friends because, you know, we're there, we're doing the thing with our kids. Other people are there often that may be at a similar point in time, whether that's career, relationship, you know, discussing, well, what's going on with my body here after I had a kid, like all that kind of stuff. It's kind of nice, huh?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much potential for shared connection over things that you would probably never connect over or never, you know, open up about. And yeah, I mean, kids, when they start out, they're just so innocent and they just want to do everything with everybody. And so, you know, that's a easy way for people to spend time together as well.
Hey folks, I want to tell you real quick about the one supplement that me and my dad, Mace, take every day for lifelong brain health. This is Relevate by NeuroReserve. You can check out neuroreserve.com/Travis Macy for 15% off. Relevate, one soft gel and two capsules daily. Again, it's a supplement that provides core dietary nutrients for lifelong brain health. Check out neuroreserve.com/Travis Macy for 15% off. Relevate. I enjoyed your interview, Beth, on the Runout podcast. We'll get that linked in the show notes. One thing you talk about there is that early in your own child's life, you kind of had some flashpoint sort of that maybe highlighted that looking into your own trauma over the a key event, really, and I can have you mention it briefly if you want, but in your early 20s, like, this was something that needed to be addressed, and some of that was I think maybe just sort of realizing how the world was being presented to your own child, that kind of stuff. Can we shift to that? And maybe if you want, for some listeners may be very familiar. Again, this is like, it's from Climbing Lore. It's been in a lot of films, movies, books, whatever. Some people may not be familiar, but maybe give us just, I don't know, the cliff notes of sort of this event. And it takes up a lot of the book. It's a story well told, but it also, it left a mark. And, you know, maybe looking back, it may seem obvious that it did. But, you know, yeah, what happened? And then how did you kind of finally start addressing it?
Yeah. So in, I was newly 20 and, Tommy and I had just started dating and we went on a climbing expedition to Kyrgyzstan with two friends, Jason Smith and John Dickey. And partway through that climbing expedition, we were, taken hostage for 6 days. And during that time, we went through like a pretty big battle between the people that took us hostage, the rebels and the Kyrgyzstan military. We were freezing, we were starving. It was a pretty harrowing time. And then at the end of those 6 days, we managed to escape and then run to safety of the Kyrgyzstan military. And honestly, the coming back was a pretty hard thing. And I can say that at the time and in retrospect. You know, that time in the climbing community, that was in 2000, surviving death and like having these harrowing tales was pretty celebrated, right? Because that's...
Yeah, feather in the cap, huh?
Exactly. Like, oh, you got to the top of the mountain and, you know, you almost died this way and that way. Like, good, like, awesome, amazing. Like, you're stronger for it. Look at all the... Yeah. Things that you learned and that sort of thing.
Better than a climb, right?
Exactly. So honestly, like coming back and I should say back then, just society in general, I feel like therapy wasn't just widely talked about or maybe even widely accepted. You know, growing up, I didn't know adults that went to therapy. I didn't know any of my parents' friends or it just, you know, wasn't a common thing like it is now. So even though we probably should have gone to therapy, and I did go to therapy just like the 6 or 8 sessions that my parents' insurance covered, because I was having really bad nightmares and not sleeping. I can't say that I was like all in, right? I was like, oh, this is kind of like hooey and I should be stronger. And I was like pretty ashamed of it. Like I didn't really tell that many people that I was going to therapy. And then after that, I kind of just like bottled it up and shoved it as like far down as I could and just dove back into climbing because, you know, I saw Tommy doing that and he was doing fine. I wanted to do that. Like, that's what I felt like I should be doing if I was strong enough and if I was rad enough. Honestly, like it kind of worked for 10, 15 years. I was able to like live in my little guardrails and believe certain things and not go certain places or be around certain type of people. And it wasn't until I became a mom and then I started to control like the life that we were trying to give our kiddo and my husband's life and my life as well, that I realized that, something that I thought I was, you know, fine with and totally didn't need to deal with and didn't need to address. It was just bubbling up in these ways that I was really not proud of. And I really didn't want to keep trying to, you know, like walk that line anymore.
Yeah. Well, good for you for realizing that, Beth, and that takes courage, whether it's therapy, whether it's realizing. You talk about a scene in the park where I think, you talk about a few scenes, one of them like 9/11, you know, that was shortly after, you know, the kidnapping and that freaked you out. You know, you like your, the story in your head was something like they're coming to get us, right? You know, they're looking for you and Tommy. And then much later on with your own child, you know, a scene in the park. Do you want to, can you tell that story or just kind of how, how sort of a light switch went on and you realize maybe this is something I want to address?
Absolutely. You know, I was just at a neighborhood park one day with our kiddo and just doing the normal thing, you know, picking up a stick and looking at it and climbing up the slide and going down the slide and just doing everything you do with a little child. Just so full of innocence and wonder and curiosity. And a family walked in and the mom was wearing a hijab and they had a kiddo similar age to ours, and I became totally panicked. And I just, you know, I had that same sour, you know, taste of fear in me, and I panicked and I picked up our kiddo and, you know, tried to smile and say out loud though, oh, it's nap time, it's time to go, you know, and then went home. But I just remember, you know, once we were at home, just how I felt was so, you know, like that sour sense of fear had now turned into this, you know, sour sense of just shame. And that's not how I wanted to be in the world. I didn't want to be somebody who, you know, was walking through life like that. And I think that was a pretty big shift in thinking that, oh, this is something that I should address. I should try and go back to therapy, even though at the time I was like, how do you do that 15 years later? Like, how do you excavate these memories that you've worked so diligently to seal away so you can, you know, get through a day or get through your life? And so, yeah, I think shortly after that, I reached out to a therapist and started therapy around Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for you. Yeah. And again, it's, that's hard work. You know, you recount some of those therapy sessions and some of the, you know, I'm sure it was super challenging and it's a journey. You know, one thing that stood out to me, just, I'd love to meet your husband, Randy. He seems like a great dude. And I love how it seems to me the often you characterize the way that he provided support was just by asking gentle questions. And I thought that was cool.
Yeah. No, he's a great guy. And I think I'm always somebody who tries to like fix things, you know, and where he's like, he doesn't explicitly say it or whatnot, but he's more of like, well, how is this, how are we feeling about this? Or like, what are your thoughts on that? Instead of like, you know, well, I'll get the sponge and wipe it up, you know, type of thing, instead of just like a fix.
Yeah. Good for him. I'm trying to be more patient and more reflective and less, less fixing, more listening.
Same.
Yeah. How about the process itself, you know, navigating the trauma through therapy, maybe also through writing. Tell us about that. You know, this book here, like, here it is, May 1st, 2024, like it's on shelves. It's a new thing to us as the audience. Like you said, to you, this thing, like, man, this is 10 years in the making. Tell us about that process. Like, writing as catharsis, has that been part of it? I'm also curious, early in the book, there's a great back and forth between the present and the past. You know, we get some play-by-play from Kyrgyzstan, and then we fast forward. So I guess the question is, you know, writing as catharsis, and then also, why did you end up choosing, you know, that literary structure?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, for the first 4 or 5 years, it was this tab open on my computer where I would just go journal or write down thoughts or process things or whatnot. And then at some point, when it was, you know, that was going to become a book, I was lucky enough to meet or work with Eva and Mark, to, you know, to help me write this, to help get this book into a book form. You know, I think I always probably naively thought, and I'm sure this works for some people, that, you know, people go off into some snowy cabin in the woods and they write their most deepest inner thoughts. And then they come out with this like masterpiece of work and it's off into the world. And, you know, I'm not that person. I'm not like this brilliant writer who can go off by myself and do that. So it was a much more collaborative experience than I had like envisioned 10 years ago, which I loved because I really like collaborating with people. And, you know, Mark was kind of like the big picture guy and structure. And then Eva just lived in my brain, poor Eva, for, you know, years. And so I feel like, you know, as far as structure and that type of thing, they were the experts and, you know, really helped tease out scenes and that type of thing. And they were really helpful, honestly, in allowing me to just like write a ton on something, right? Like I would just write about therapy and scenes and go as deep as possible. And I think it was just this pretty vulnerable relationship I had with him because it was just this wide open door into like all my inner thoughts and that type of thing. And so, I don't know. It felt like a very safe place, right? To writing this book felt safe because it was just like this little world where it was just me for the longest time. And then just like the three of us for the longest time. And so, yeah, now it's getting out into the world and it definitely seems maybe a little bit more reckless than that little safe place. But also, you know, like I said before, I feel like I gained so much from reading other people's stories and hearing other people's stories, and that connection, I think, is something that's really strong and needed between humans.
Yeah. Oh man, I love it, and actually, it reminds me a lot of the writing process I've done for my books, which have also been collaborative. And I found, especially in writing with stuff, we did a book like about my dad's journey with Alzheimer's, and there were things that I was not, like, I wasn't ready to go into it alone because it was so hard, and reading through. He did some journaling kind of when he could still write early in the process. And like, I wasn't ready to read those. Like, I couldn't, but because I had a teammate who could look into that with me, he made a journey possible that I couldn't do on my own.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I feel like it's a pretty, pretty amazing relationship, you know, you have with that person. You know, it's not like, mm-hmm. It's more than friend and less than therapist, yeah. Or something like that, you know? So, but it's like, yeah. A pretty, pretty amazing relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of like you got a teammate for life, you know, like wherever your paths go, or however much you're in touch with Mark and Eva, like, yeah, man, they're in it with you. And that's awesome. Do you ever, you know, you said, okay, you're not locking yourself away, you know, in some snowy cabin. I think didn't like Barack Obama did that. He was working on some book and he just, whatever, went to this cabin. Like, yeah, I don't do that either. Like, I'm curious, does some of your writing, does it come out when you're active? Let's say you're, you know, I'd imagine climbing, but you do other stuff too. You talk about biking, you talk about running. Like, do your ideas often come to you while you're doing that? And are you dictating into the phone? Or you type in notes, or is it always kind of, oh, it's noon or one or whatever, and I sit down and I'm writing? How does that actually work for you?
Yeah, I feel like I have no rhyme or reason to it, but I do often find it's when I'm away from people or my family, you know, mm-hmm. And I can kind of just have like, yep. Some quiet space. So a lot of times, like if I'm out for a walk or a run or a hike, like my mind will just start working in a different way than it does when I'm at home or, you know, mm-hmm. in the car with people or whatnot. Honestly, a lot of times, things come to me in the car when nobody's in the car, and I start to think about it. And then other times I'm like putting away the dishes or something like that. But I do find I didn't ever really think about it, but I feel like once the pandemic happened and like people started working at home and kids were at home, I realized, I was like, oh wow, I just don't have any more thoughts, right? I don't have any more coherent thoughts because people are around me all the time. And so, I feel like that alone time is, you know, kind of when I start to have that, those thoughts, and when I can go into my computer and write or whatnot.
Let's shift gears a little bit if we can. You reflect on your journey as a professional sponsored climber, and specifically as a female professional sponsored climber. You know, we talked about, I think, especially early in your career, you say, okay, you know, you got these quote climbing teams, you know, you got a main brand, whether it's, you know, I don't know, Sportiva or one of these other ones, and they have a team, and you say, usually there was one woman on the team, and you know, the salaries were lower, the benefits were less, you know, there wasn't the automatic, whatever, you and Tommy would climb the same thing or something, and his salary would go up X percentage and yours would go up maybe some, but less. There was a lot of, again, competition between female athletes for a small percentage of it. And it was also, I think at that time, it was kind of all about the magazine cover, right? The gods of magazines, they decide who sent what, and they get on the cover and boom, that's the key. You know, what's changed? What's the same? Is there more, you know, equality between male and female athletes? Is it, you know, how do things look? And then also, you know, we throw in this whole social media, like that's a, you know, the athlete influencer type thing. That's a lot different than it was even, you know, like when I was, you know, seeking sponsorships or whatever in the early 2000s, like, you know, probably like you like copied out magazine clippings and newspaper stuff, and you show it to the sponsor like, look at this, look what, you know, it wasn't about followers or anything like that, because that didn't exist.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, it was a lot was a lot different back then, right? It was like, it was all about the magazines. It was all about, you know, what film festivals you could get into. It was, and that's how, that was kind of like the credibility that then sponsors looked at, right? Like that was your resume. It wasn't, what have you done? Or what have you said you're done? Or what are you going to say you're doing? It's more like, what magazine covers have you got on? What articles have you been in? You know, that type of thing. So in that regard, I feel like things have changed, you know, 180 degrees, right? Like there are some magazines out there, but that's definitely not like the Holy Bible on what, how sponsors, you know, choose their athletes or whatnot, which I think honestly is like, it's a blessing and a curse, right? It's like,
yeah,
to have a platform for people to have their own voices. I think it's given life to people and given life an opportunity to people that didn't have that before, didn't have that chance. But then maybe it's magnified things that, you know, might not have gotten the recognition or deserved the recognition that it gets. So I feel like it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword there. But yeah, back then, I mean, now it's like you had a token female two on the team, like the token female expedition of the year, that type of thing. And now I feel like, obviously I can only speak to my own experience, back then versus now, but like there's so many more women on teams now, right? Like there's so much more equity on teams now. I'm obviously not married to Tommy anymore and nor any other professional climber. So I don't know what salaries are like. That was just like a very simple way to compare, right? I could see what I had got and what he got and that type of thing. So I think it's moving in the right direction. Whether we've arrived or ever will arrive at the finish line, I don't know, but it's definitely going in the right direction.
Yeah. Oh, good. That's good to hear. Mm-hmm. It seems like also maybe the newer landscape, I think maybe allows athletes to contribute in different ways. I think that you're, you know, I don't really follow social media and stuff, but you talk in the book, you know, about continuing as a sponsored climber. And I think a lot of what you're offering though is a super powerful and influential story and a relatable story, like that people, you know, whether it's someone, whether it's a mom, a dad, or, you know, someone else, like most, yes, it's great to see the aspirational stories of people climbing stuff or athletes doing stuff, you know, that is way beyond what most people would ever consider doing. But it's also like, it's super cool to see like, oh, here's how someone is like balancing this with their work, their family, their, you know, their aging body, their injuries. What do you think about that? Have you kind of, am I reading that correctly? And have you like enjoyed doing that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's, you know, one of the blessings of social media. And just giving people another voice, right, to speak out. In that, yeah, I haven't pushed the level of climbing forward in well over a decade, you know, 15 years probably. But I continue to work with companies and be a sponsored climber. And it's been pretty amazing in that way to see that people can still have a voice. There is still relevance. You know, it's not only about pushing the level higher, which I do think is an incredibly important part of our sport, right? To see where it can go athletically and physically. But I also feel like there's so much more that's needed in sport and in the communities surrounding sports. Whether it's talking about hard things like body image or equity or whatnot. But I think to be able to shine a light on those things is really important as well.
Yeah. Excellent. Glad to hear. How about for in case there are some, you know, some of the more climbing focused audience listening, you talk in the book about a few of key climbs, you know, these projects, these things that you put work into oftentimes for years, you know, whether it's the nose or meltdown or magic line or something. I don't know, do you want to choose any of those or other ones in the book or even not in the book, just any, you know, something that sticks with you or maybe that has a special place for you, whether it was the journey or the outcome, the people who were with you, whatever.
Oh gosh. I feel like that's hard to pick one. But yeah, I feel like it's probably hard to not say the nose because I started climbing the year that, you know, Lynn freed the nose. And so I had no idea what the nose was or who Lynn was or anything like that. But
yep.
It's just like the only thing you saw in climbing for the next year. And, you know,
and that's for the audience. That's Lynn Hill. And remind me, was that 1990 or?
I think she did. I can't remember if she did she did it in a few days in 94 and then in a day in 95 or if it was 93 okay. and 94. I can't remember like the exact
something like
days.
That. But it something was like huge. That. And no one had done it. And her tagline was "It goes, boys." And, yeah. and then no one did it for a long, like it was just too hard. Right. Remind me, were you and Tommy the next ones to do it?
Yeah. I feel like, well, it depends on some climbers like to put asterisks by things.
Different ways of climbing, all kinds of style.
Exactly.
Yep.
So I think Tommy and I considered ourselves to be trying for the third ascent.
Okay.
But yeah, it's, you know, it's just like, she was so ahead of her time. You know, it's like, even now somebody to free climb the nose, it's like a pretty big deal, you know, and it's what, 30 years later. A lot of like roots on LCAP get freed all the time. The nose doesn't get freed that much. The nose doesn't get freed that much in a day, right? Like it is a big deal what she did. And so to like have kind of this larger than life person in my mind and larger than life climbing accomplishment, and then actually one day be able to do it. I just remember that like that's something that I don't think you experience all the time. So I feel like doing the nose was definitely up there.
Nice. Cool. Thanks for sharing. And that for people who don't have perspective, like what are we talking? How many pitches and how much, I mean, you guys were training specifically for that. What was it? I don't know. Was it one season, multiple seasons, but you're hanging on the wall, you're figuring out the holds, all the pitches, like days and days, weeks and weeks, hanging on the wall, figuring out the little spots. Like you don't just go up there and start climbing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some people can, that was not our experience. You know, some people can definitely walk up to LCAP and go right up it and free it. And Tommy can do that. Like Tommy was able to do that on a lot of routes, you know, he like almost ground up on sighted several routes in a day. But the nose took work because the nose is hard. And I feel like that's kind of like the genre of climbing that I like, and I kind of identify with is the ones that really make you work for it, not kind of these like fluffy routes that you just like get to check the box and be like, oh, I climbed this, like I free climbed LCAP, check, you know, like there's a big difference between free climbing LCAP and free climbing the nose on LCAP. It's like, it's a hard route. We worked really hard on it. It's probably the most famous route in the world. So there's always other people on it that you're kind of like juggling around. And it's like 30 pitches ish, you know, it goes right up the center of LCAP. It's the nose for the reason it's like the center of LCAP goes right up the middle. And, there's two kind of infamous pitches, the Great Roof and the Changing Corners. And usually for most people, it just comes down to if they can do the Changing Corners, and we were able to do it. So.
Cool. Yeah. Excellent. Well, yeah, that, you know, for the climbing enthusiasts or just, you know, adventure lovers, sports lovers, I think people are going to love that in the book, just getting the play by play, you know, of, you know, the making the climbs, you know, the final send, but also like the preparation, you know, I really enjoyed hearing about all that. Final topic, Beth, before we let you run back to everything else you have going on, you got kid stuff. I'm sure, here we are close to your book launch. That's a busy time, exciting time, fun time. But the last topic, body image. And this is, I really appreciate how you discuss your journey here. How do we see our bodies? Is the body a machine, a tool, something that's just for performance? Looking at weight and body composition, restrictive eating patterns, dieting, all this kind of stuff. I think it's really relevant. I think we can't dispute that in the sport of climbing, which is your sport, or sports I like, running, biking, uphill skiing, basically anything where you're especially going up, like weight is a factor. Weight to strength is a factor. And it's more than that. Like health is a factor, eating, enjoying eating, all that kind of stuff. I don't know. What are your thoughts? How do we support young people with this? I think, my kids are 11 and 13, and my daughter at age 11, she's starting to, as she does sports, as she just, the messages, I think, especially for young women about bodies, they're everywhere. How can we support people with that? How do we have the hard conversations? You say early in the book, your parents only had one hard conversation with you growing up. And I don't know if you say what it was, but I think it seems like you think probably more it's important to have hard conversations. So anyway, long question. What do you think? How can we support people?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a great question. And I'm no expert, right? Like I feel like it's good to have actual experts, therapists, people that nutritionists, whatever, that doctors that know about that. But I do think one thing, just as a community, that I see happening slowly is to not have it in the shadows anymore, right? Like when I started climbing, eating issues were everywhere, but never talked about, right? Like everybody was, not everybody, a lot of people were rail thin. That's what you saw in magazines. That's what you saw on the videos. Things were said to me that weren't ever in malintent, I think, but were just kind of off the cuff, or maybe even trying to be helpful because that's probably what helped them, like people, like I had a mentor tell me that, they lost 5 pounds before every competition. I remember this one day going out climbing, and we stopped by the bagel shop, and I was just like this kid, like pretty green into climbing, I didn't know much, and I did what I did every time I went to the bagel shop, and I ordered, 2 bagels with cream cheese, and somebody said, well, you're not going to get anything today after eating that, Rodden, and so it's just like these little things that I don't think, that could have been construed as jokes or off the cuff or something, but they make a difference. You add up dozen of those, 50 of those, 100 of those over the years. And you're like, oh, this is what I clearly need to be doing if I want to succeed and achieve, and success and achievements, what's celebrated in the sport. So that's what I want to be doing. So I think now what I'm seeing, and obviously like I'm not a teenage girl in climbing right now, so I can't speak to that, but what I'm seeing is it's talked about more, it's open. It's not, I've had friends with daughters that have had issues and they've gone to therapy, and, the therapy is very much like, this is not your fault. This is, something that we can work on type of thing.
Not something wrong with you.
Exactly. And I think honestly, now you see a lot of different body types in marketing and in advertisements and in climbing and in sports. Yep. You see like with the influx of bouldering, like it's a different body type. And so it's like very much strength instead of, lightness. You see top climbers talking about it. So I just think all that probably helps. Again, I'm not an expert, but I can just try and imagine if I was a teenage kid and if I heard people talking about it, if I heard that it wasn't the only path to success, that there's also detriments to doing that, maybe things would have been a bit different for me.
Thanks for sharing that, Beth. And it's good to hear of the the progress. You're right about those subtle bits of language, and those exist, you know. Yeah, all these sports, running, biking, you know, whatever. Someone shows up at a race, oh, you're looking fit, or like, you know, okay, well, what is how you look? You can't tell someone's whatever what training they've been doing, like, but what does that mean? Well, probably, you know, that's a comment regarding body composition, right? And I think I also think it's really important. We often think of body image and eating challenges as sort of women's issues, but it's not. Like, these are things that, you know, many men experience challenges or a journey or maybe walking a line of what's healthy or not healthy, or, you know, stories in the head. And I think it's I think it's important to talk about that. Yeah, and especially have you know, role models like you sharing their stories, because it really helps people.
Yeah, you know, I really think that things are good talked about.
Yeah, good. Well, and that's I think that's a lot of point of this book, Beth. It's great stories, again, vulnerability, and also just, I think, stuff we can learn from, you know, wisdom we can learn from. So congratulations, awesome book, really enjoyed it. Where should people find you, Beth? Whether that's you know, online, I'm sure social media and stuff, but what about, I mean, do you have, are you should they look for you at in-person events, or is there anything coming out with the book? How can they connect?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I'm a sporadic poster on Instagram. So, but that's kind of where I go if I am going to do anything. So you can find me on Instagram. And then, yeah, I'm doing just a, you know, a handful of events, mostly in Northern California, and then one in Colorado, and then one in Austin right now. But yeah, maybe more will pop up. That's it right now.
Cool. Are those events on your, is it BethRodden.com, and are those on the website, you know, or?
They're not on there right yet, cause we haven't finalized all the details, but hopefully this week they'll be up there, but yeah.
Great.
Then,
well, cool.
Then
so
they can
a
go
light through the cracks. Yeah. People got to check it out. May 1st. Awesome book. Remind me, audio, a lot of athletes like audiobooks. Is there an audiobook now? Is it coming?
Yes, there's an audiobook, and I recorded it a couple months ago. So it's
all right. Great.
It's me reading it for 10 or 11 hours.
Good. Oh, that's awesome. I love it when I love hearing the author's voice. Great. That's awesome. I think people are going to enjoy that when they're out bouldering, climbing, biking, driving, whatever. The Colorado event, do you know when and where, or should we check the website for that as well?
It will be on May 7th at the Sportiva store, the new Sportiva store on Pearl Street, but we're just kind of sorting out timing and capacity and stuff like that. So once we get all that, the pieces in place, I'll definitely shout it from the rooftops.
Great. Good for you. Cool. No better place than Pearl Street to have a nice climbing event. Yeah. All righty. Well, thanks so much, Beth. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much. That was really fun.
All right, folks, thanks as always for listening to the podcast. Thanks again to Beth. Great interview. Really appreciate her taking the time. And again, just highly recommend Beth's new book, A Light Through the Cracks. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, if you're into climbing and you follow kind of some of the stories and lore over time, you got to read this. And if you're not into climbing, if you're just a human being, you know, who's interested and learning about wisdom and personal development over time, maybe in navigating trauma, there's a lot of stuff here in this book. It's not just you know, climbing stories. So check it out wherever books are found on May 1st. Thanks again to Rourke, our presenting sponsor, Rourke.com. Use the code MACY15. For 15% off, Rourke invites you to run a mock. At Rourke, we believe there's no better way to see the world around you than by running through it. Our insatiable curiosity of the world leads us to constantly seek trails less traveled. Our experience has led us to cutting a new path in performance apparel that values expression as much as it does function. Rourke's journey provides a unique perspective on trail running and active wear, born from adventure somewhere between freedom and chaos. Again, check that out, guys. Rourke.com, Macy15 for 15% off. One of Beth's upcoming events very soon here next week, May 7th. Sounds like she's going to be at the La Sportiva store in Boulder on Pearl Street. Check it out. That's going to be awesome. And, you know, while I still have the mic, hey, maybe you'll turn me off. Maybe you'll keep listening. My latest Rourke story, you know, I went out Boulder nightlife a couple weeks ago. My buddies from high school and college, I've been so thankful in friendship in my life, including new friends, friends through the endurance racing world, and also just my old friends. I've had the same close friends from when I was a young child, and I'm so thankful to have those relationships and to still be in touch with these childhood friends. We went out a couple weeks ago in Boulder, starting at 8 p.m., which I got to tell you, man, for me, that is a stretch. Only for people I truly love would I venture out. It was actually in a snowstorm, starting at the late hour of 8 p.m. In Boulder. We went to the Sink out there on the hill. The Sink is still there, folks. That restaurant, you know, when you graduate from CU Boulder like I did, you're so proud that you've made it through the Harvard of the West, that you celebrate your graduation with a shot of hard alcohol from the Sink. I don't like hard alcohol, but, you know, I was stoked to graduate, and I went to the Sink and got my shot. Geez, 20 years ago now, and this is the first time I've been back. So we had some pizza at the Sink. They had a Heineken non-alcoholic beer that I enjoyed. We had some fries and just a great time hanging out with my friends. But back to the Rourke, I was wearing my Hebrides jacket by Rourke. This is a, you know, it's a style item. It's corduroy. It's got that that cuff around the neck that you kind of fold down, and it has stuff that looks like soft sheepskin or something on it, you know. But anyway, it's a cool jacket, and it is, I've said it before, you know, I'm punching above my weight here when it comes to style when I wear the Rourke stuff. But there I was out on the hill late at night hanging out with my buddies. Here we are, a bunch of, you know, 40-year-old dudes in a restaurant. And then we went to a bar. We're in there with college kids. And truly, they look like kids, which, you know, boy, is weird. They're much closer to my kids' age than my age. But point aside, all of my friends were commenting on my jacket, my Rourke Hebrides jacket. So, anyway, you know, if you want your friends, you know, to think you're cool as you're aging like me, check out one of these jackets. Again, Rourke.com. All right, guys, we'll leave you at that. If you want to check out my stuff, TravisMacy.com. My books are on there, The Ultra Mindset and A Mile at a Time. My endurance coaching information and speaking information are there as well. We always appreciate it so much. If you have a minute, like the podcast, give a rating. Those, especially 5-star ratings, they really help us in the metrics and the algorithms, or so I'm told. And even share this podcast with someone. You know, just hit that share button and text it on over to a friend if it's something that you enjoy listening to. All right, guys, thanks again. Have a great week. We will catch you next week on The Travis Macy Show. The Travis Macy Show is produced and edited by the team at Palm Tree Pod Co. Anthony Palmer is the executive producer, and Garrett Wright is the associate producer. Thanks to our digital team, Emily Miles and Caitlin Krings. The content for this episode was created by me, Travis Macy.